A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He grew up fascinated by Israel's borders, spent hours on Google Maps tracing the fence lines, and eventually visited almost all of them. His core observation is something most people don't realize. The border fence you see is rarely on the actual border. Israel builds its fences slightly inside its own territory, declares a closed military zone even before that, and the result is two slivers of no man's land that most people don't know exist. He's also asking about the human side. When border patrols face each other across the same stretch of isolated terrain for years, do they eventually recognize each other? Can pleasantries be exchanged? Do they ever collaborate? There's a lot to unpack here.
The timing is right for this. Over 70 countries now have border walls or fences, up from just 15 in 1989. That's according to Elizabeth Vallet's work on border fortification. We're living through the biggest wave of border hardening since the Cold War, and almost nobody talks about what these structures actually look like on the ground.
The dissonance is the interesting part. We think of borders as clean lines on a map. You're in one country, then you're in another. But the physical reality is a mess of graded dirt tracks, sensor cables, secondary fences, and these accidental no-man's lands that emerge whether anyone planned them or not. The line on Google Maps is almost never where the fence sits.
That gap between the fence and the actual border, that's not a bug, it's the whole story. Let's start with the three layers. You've got the de jure international boundary, which is the treaty line, the legal border. Then you've got the de facto security perimeter, which is where the fence actually stands. And then you've got the administrative close zone, the buffer inside the fence where civilians aren't allowed. Three different lines, all supposedly the same border.
Israel is the perfect case study for this, partly because almost all its borders are now fenced, and partly because the deviations between the fence line and the treaty line are so well documented. Take the separation barrier in the West Bank. It's 7-8 kilometers long, but only 15% of it follows the green line, the 1949 armistice line. 85% of it deviates into the West Bank, in some places by up to 22 kilometers.
That's a politically loaded case, obviously, because of the settlements and the territory claims. But even on Israel's internationally recognized borders, where nobody disputes where the line goes, the fence still doesn't sit on the line. The fence with Lebanon, the fence with Egypt, the fence with Jordan, in every case, the physical barrier is set back inside Israeli territory.
Which raises the question, if the fence isn't on the border, where is it and why?
The answer is partly engineering and partly doctrine. Israel uses a system called Yodfat on several of its borders. It's a 5-meter steel mesh fence with fiber optic intrusion detection sensors buried underground, topped with razor wire. On the Israeli side of the fence, there's a graded dirt track, a sterile zone they call it, that's raked smooth, so any footprint shows up immediately. That track is typically 30 to 100 meters inside the fence, and the fence itself is set back from the actual border by roughly the same distance. So you've got this layered sandwich, borderline, then a gap of 50 to 100 meters, then the fence, then the graded track, then a closed military zone extending anywhere from 100 to 500 meters further in.
On the other side.
That's where it gets interesting. On the Lebanese side, Hezbollah has observation posts within meters of the blue line. The blue line is the UN-drawn withdrawal line from 2000, and it's the de facto border. But Israel's technical fence sits 50 to 100 meters south of it. So you've got this 100-meter gap where UNIFIL patrols, but neither the IDF nor the Lebanese armed forces operate directly. It's functionally no man's land, even though no treaty calls it that.
The gap emerges by default. Two parallel enforcement regimes that don't quite touch.
And this is the universal principle. Every fenced border creates a no man's land, whether it's intentional or not. Even the US-Mexico border, people think of the fence as being on the border, but Customs and Border Protection operates what's called the 100-mile zone. It extends 100 miles inland from any U.S. border, covering roughly two-thirds of the American population. That's not a buffer zone in the physical sense, but it's a legal one, an area where CBP has expanded search and seizure authority without a warrant.
100 miles. That's not a buffer, that's a jurisdiction.
The ACLU has been fighting this for years. But the point is, even on a border where the fence does sit right on the line in many places, the enforcement architecture creates a zone, not a line.
Let's talk about the engineering taxonomy, because not all fences are the same. The YODFAT system you mentioned is designed for a specific threat profile, infiltration by individuals or small teams on foot. The U.S.-Mexico border uses something completely different in most places, 18-foot steel bollards set in concrete with a 5-foot anti-climb plate on top. That's the post-2017 design. Before that, you had Normandy-style vehicle barriers in the desert, these big steel X-shaped crosses designed to stop trucks, not people.
The engineering tells you exactly what each country is worried about. Israel's layered system with underground fiber optics is designed to detect tunneling as much as overland infiltration. That's a direct response to Hamas's tunnel network from Gaza and Hezbollah's tunnel attempts from Lebanon. The U.S. bollard design is about stopping mass pedestrian crossings and vehicle ramming. The India-Pakistan border in Punjab has floodlights so intense they're visible from space. It's about visibility and deterrence in a high-traffic sector.
The Korean DMZ is the extreme case. 4 kilometers wide, 250 kilometers long, roughly 1 million landmines, and an estimated 2 million troops within 100 kilometers of the line. The military demarcation line runs down the center, but both sides maintain a 2-kilometer buffer, and the actual fence lines are 1 to 2 kilometers inside each side's territory. So the no man's land is codified by the 1953 armistice, but the physical barriers don't sit on the MDL either.
That's the pattern everywhere. The country building the fence always builds it inside its own territory. Partly that's legal. You can't build on someone else's land without it being an act of war or annexation. Partly it's practical. You need access to maintain the fence, and you don't want your maintenance crews exposed on the other side. But the effect is always the same. You create a strip of your own territory that you're functionally ceding as a buffer.
Which is a strange trade-off. You're giving up physical control of a sliver of your own land to gain security for everything behind it.
The width of that sliver is a direct measure of the threat you perceive. Israel's closed military zone on the Lebanese border is relatively narrow, a few hundred meters, because the terrain is hilly and the front line is heavily militarized on both sides. But on the Jordanian border, in the Jordan River Valley, you've got a different regime entirely. The 1994 peace treaty set the border down the middle of the Jordan River, but Israel maintains a seam zone 3 to 5 kilometers wide in the West Bank. The fence sits on the Israeli side of the river, Jordanian patrols stay on their bank, and the river itself becomes the de facto no man's land.
The river as buffer. That's the oldest border technology there is, and it still works.
It does, but it creates weird dynamics. The Jordan River isn't exactly the Mississippi. In summer, it's more of a stream in places. You could wade across. So the buffer function isn't really about the water, it's about the mutual agreement that neither side patrols in the riverbed itself. Both sides maintain observation from their respective banks, and the gap between them is where anything interesting would happen.
The Golan Heights is the most formalized version of this. The 1974 disengagement agreement between Israel and Syria created something called the Area of Separation, a 235 square kilometer demilitarized zone patrolled by UNDOF, the UN Disengagement Observer Force, about 1,200 personnel. The agreement specifies exactly what forces and weapons are allowed within 25 kilometers of the Alpha Line on the Israeli side and the Bravo Line on the Syrian side.
This is the rare case where the no man's land is actually codified in a treaty. Most buffer zones are accidental or de facto. The Golan AOS is de jure. It exists because both sides signed a document saying it exists. The Alpha and Bravo lines aren't the border, they're the limits of Israeli and Syrian forward deployment. The actual border is somewhere in between, and UNDOF patrols the gap.
Of course there are.
The agreement limits each side to 6,000 troops, 75 tanks, and 36 artillery pieces within the 25-kilometer zone. UNDOF inspects both sides and reports violations. and since the Syrian civil war started, the AOS has been breached multiple times by Syrian forces, by rebel groups, by Iranian-backed militias. UNDOF personnel were actually kidnapped by armed groups in 2014 and had to relocate their positions.
Which brings us to the human dimension. You've got these elaborate physical structures, these treaty zones, these sensor arrays, but at the end of the day, there are people standing on both sides, looking at each other. And Daniel's question about whether they eventually recognize each other, that's not hypothetical.
It's extremely well documented, especially on the Israel-Lebanon border. IDF positions and Lebanese armed forces positions are often within 50 to 100 meters of each other. Hezbollah observation posts are even closer to the blue line in some sectors. These are soldiers who patrol the same stretch of border every day in isolated areas for months or years. They learn each other's faces, they learn each other's vehicles, they learn each other's routines.
There's something almost intimate about it, despite the hostility.
There are documented cases of soldiers shouting greetings across the border, waving. There was a 2019 incident where an IDF soldier waved a white flag to retrieve a drone that had fallen on the Lebanese side, and the Lebanese soldier waved back and allowed the retrieval. No diplomacy, no formal channel, just two guys who'd been looking at each other for months and had developed enough mutual recognition to handle a minor incident without escalation.
Then, in 2006, Hezbollah launched a cross-border raid that killed three soldiers and kidnapped two others, and that started a war. So these micro-level relationships exist, but they exist on a knife's edge.
The unwritten rules are fascinating. During quiet periods, both sides tacitly agree to maintain what amounts to a live-and-let-live posture. You don't test the fence, we don't escalate minor incursions. You retrieve your equipment that fell on our side, we'll look the other way. But these rules are completely informal. They're not in any agreement. They're not even necessarily communicated. They just emerge because both sides have an interest in routine and predictability.
The military equivalent of neighbors who don't like each other but agree not to mow the lawn at 7 a.m. on Saturday.
And the communication channels that backstop these informal understandings are more robust than most people realize. Even between countries with no diplomatic relations, there are established channels. The UNIFIL liaison office in Nakoura in southern Lebanon has hosted over 15,000 tripartite meetings between IDF and Lebanese armed forces officers since 2007. That's weekly meetings, sometimes more, where officers from both sides sit in the same room, technically with UNIFIL as intermediary, and discuss border incidents, violations, deconfliction.
15,000 meetings. That's not an exception. That's a routine.
On the Syria-Israel border, UNDOF facilitates indirect communication via a hotline between Israeli and Syrian officers. It's not direct. A UNDOF officer relays messages, but it's functional. On the Jordan-Israel border, there's direct communication via something called the Bridging Office at the King Hussein Bridge. Jordan and Israel have a peace treaty, so that's different, but even during cold periods, that channel stays open.
The Russians are involved on the Syrian side now. Since 2015, Israel and Russia have maintained a military hotline to prevent accidental clashes in Syrian airspace. Russian military police actually patrol the Syrian side of the Bravo line in some sectors.
There was a bizarre moment in 2018. Someone dubbed it the Golan Heights WhatsApp group, which isn't literally true but captures the spirit. Israeli and Russian officers were using the deconfliction hotline to coordinate movements near the border. You've got Israeli officers talking to Russian officers about Syrian territory, all to prevent the kind of accidental encounter that could spiral into something much worse.
The paradox is that border forces often have more in common with each other than with their own civilian populations. They share the same operational challenges: smuggling, infiltration, human trafficking. They both want predictability. They both want to avoid dying in an accidental firefight over nothing.
There was a 2018 incident where Jordanian and Israeli border police jointly intercepted a drug smuggling attempt coming from Syria toward the Jordan-Israel border. They coordinated via radio. The countries are technically at peace, but the relationship has been frosty for years. Yet the operational logic of stopping a third-party threat overrode the political tension.
That's the thing about borders. They're simultaneously the most artificial and the most practical of human constructions. The line is imaginary, but the consequences of not managing it are very real.
When the border is tight, when the buffer zone is lethal, the human dimension gets very dark. The Mediterranean migration crisis, Frontex data shows over 28,000 deaths in the Mediterranean since 2014. That's not a land border, but it's the same principle. The gap between enforcement regimes becomes a death zone.
The U.S.-Mexico border, over 7,800 migrant deaths since 2014, most in the Sonoran Desert. The buffer isn't a fenced no man's land in the same way. In many places, it's just desert, but the effect is identical. There's a space where state responsibility becomes ambiguous, where people fall through the cracks, and where the physical environment does the enforcement.
That ambiguity is, in some ways, the point. If you build a fence and declare a buffer zone inside your own territory, you've created a space where your own laws apply in theory but not in practice. Anyone who enters that space is in legal limbo. They're on your territory, but they're not in your jurisdiction in any meaningful sense until they reach the fence.
Which is why the buffer zone is always wider than it needs to be for purely military purposes. 100 meters of graded dirt doesn't provide more security than 50 meters of graded dirt. But it does provide a larger space where ambiguous things can happen without triggering the formal apparatus of the state.
Let's talk about the misconception that hostile border forces never communicate. The reality is that even between enemies, the channels are almost always open. The question isn't whether communication exists, it's whether it's direct or mediated, formal or informal, routine or crisis only.
On the Israel-Lebanon border, there's actually a physical structure at Ras al-Nakura where the tripartite meetings happen. It's a UN compound right on the border. Israeli and Lebanese officers enter through separate gates, sit in the same room, and discuss things like, your patrol crossed 3 meters past the blue line. At coordinates such and such, we observed a new observation post being constructed. There was an explosion near the fence. Can you explain? It's bureaucratic, it's tedious, and it's what prevents small incidents from becoming wars.
The UNIFIL model is actually the most developed version of this. The Tripartite Forum was established after the 2006 war, and it's become the primary mechanism for managing the border. Both sides come with lists of incidents and violations. Agreements are reached on specific, concrete issues. Reposition a camera here, remove an obstacle there, clarify patrol routes. It's not peacemaking, it's incident management. But in a frozen conflict, incident management is what keeps the freeze from thawing.
Incident management as the unglamorous backbone of international security.
It works because both sides have an interest in it working. The IDF doesn't want a war with Hezbollah over a misunderstanding. Hezbollah doesn't want a war with Israel over a fence post, so they both use the channel, even though they'd never admit publicly that they're coordinating anything.
The professionalism point is worth dwelling on. Daniel mentioned that border forces in isolated areas probably recognize each other, and the evidence suggests they do more than that. They develop what sociologists call boundary recognition. It's not friendship, necessarily, but it's a form of mutual acknowledgement that makes coexistence possible.
There's a term for this in border studies, the local border traffic regime. It's usually applied to civilian populations, communities on either side of a border that have cross-border economic and social ties despite the official line. But the military version is similar. Soldiers assigned to the same sector for extended periods develop local knowledge. They know which patrols are routine and which are unusual. They know the personalities on the other side. They know when something feels wrong.
That local knowledge is a form of intelligence that no satellite or sensor can replicate. It's the human layer on top of the physical infrastructure.
Which raises the question of what happens when you replace humans with autonomous systems. If you've got drones and ground sensors and AI monitoring doing the surveillance, you lose the human recognition layer. The machine doesn't know that the guy on the other side has been there for 3 years and always waves at the same time. The machine just sees a human at the fence.
That's a terrifying thought. We're building these increasingly sophisticated border monitoring systems. Israel is a leader in this, with companies like Elbit and Rafael developing autonomous border surveillance platforms, and they might actually make borders more dangerous by removing the informal human deconfliction that prevents escalation.
There's a real tension here. The autonomous systems are better at detection. They don't get tired, they don't get bored, they don't look away. But they're worse at judgment. A human patrol commander knows that the shepherd who grazes his flock near the fence every day isn't a threat. An AI system might flag him every single time.
The shepherd is false positive. That's the border management version of the trolley problem.
It's not theoretical. Israel has been experimenting with autonomous border surveillance for years. The Gaza border fence is now equipped with remotely operated weapon stations, machine guns that can be fired from a control room miles away. The human is still in the loop, but the distance between observer and observed is growing.
Let's pull back to the broader principle. What Daniel's observation, that the fence isn't on the border, really reveals is that borders are not lines but zones. The width of the zone is a physical manifestation of the political relationship. When you see a wide buffer, you're seeing a history of violence and a future of tension.
The Korean DMZ is 4 kilometers wide because 3 years of war killed millions of people and ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. The Golan AOS is a few hundred meters to a few kilometers wide because the 1973 war ended with a disengagement agreement that was designed to prevent another surprise attack. The Israel-Lebanon buffer is narrow because the 2006 war ended with a UN resolution that pushed for a different kind of arrangement. Every buffer zone has a specific historical origin, and you can read that history in its width.
On borders where there's genuine peace, say, the US-Canada border, the buffer zone effectively doesn't exist. There's no fence, no graded track, no closed military zone. The border is a line on a map and sometimes a clearing in the forest. And that's it. The width of the zone is zero because the political relationship doesn't require a zone.
The Schengen zone in Europe is the extreme version of this. Internal borders between Schengen countries have no physical infrastructure at all. You can drive from France to Germany without slowing down. But the external borders of Schengen, say the Hungary-Serbia border, are heavily fortified, with fences, thermal cameras, and patrols. The border is a zone when it faces outward, and a non-zone when it faces inward.
Which tells you that borders are fundamentally about political relationships, non-geography. The same river, the same mountain range, the same stretch of desert can be a hard border or a soft border, depending entirely on who's on each side and how they feel about each other.
Here's the actionable part for anyone listening. Next time you look at a border on Google Maps, zoom in on the fence line. Look for the graded dirt track. Look for the secondary fence. Look for the watchtowers and the vehicle patrol roads. The distance between the fence and the actual border, that's a direct measure of trust, or the lack of it.
On Google Maps, you can actually see this on the Israel-Egypt border. The fence is clearly visible as a dark line in the desert, and if you zoom in, you can see the patrol road on the Israeli side. The actual border is a few dozen meters further out. It's all right there, publicly visible for anyone who knows what to look for.
The India-Pakistan border is even more dramatic from space. The floodlights make it one of the most visible human structures on Earth at night. You can trace the entire line of control just by following the lights.
We've covered the engineering, the legal architecture, and the human dynamics. What does this actually mean for how we should think about borders?
I think the key insight is that the physical infrastructure tells you more about the relationship than the treaty line does. A border that's described as peaceful in diplomatic language might have a 100-meter buffer zone with sensors and patrols, which tells you that the peace is managed, not organic. A border that's described as hostile might have regular tripartite meetings and informal communication channels, which tells you that even hostility has rules.
The fence is a text. You can read it.
And the second insight is that no man's lands are not a relic of World War I. They're a feature of every fenced border in the world today. From the U.S.-Mexico border, where the enforcement zone extends 100 miles inland, to the Green Line in Cyprus, where a UN buffer zone has divided the island since 1974, to the India-Pakistan border, where the line of control has a de facto buffer on both sides, the pattern is universal.
Cyprus is an interesting parallel. The UN buffer zone in Nicosia is only a few meters wide in places. There are abandoned buildings inside it, frozen in time since 1974, with bullet holes still visible. It's the same principle as the Golan AOS, just compressed into an urban setting.
The social dynamics are similar. UNFICP, the UN force in Cyprus, facilitates communication between Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot authorities. There are regular meetings, incident management protocols, the whole apparatus. It's the same model as UNIFIL and UNDOF, adapted to a different conflict.
The UN has the world's border concierge service.
It's not a glamorous role, but it's probably the most underappreciated function the UN performs. These observer forces and liaison offices prevent more conflicts than most people realize, precisely because they operate below the level of public attention. Nobody writes headlines about the tripartite meeting that resolved the fence dispute before it escalated.
What happens as climate change drives migration and resource scarcity? We're going to see more borders hardening, more fences going up, more buffer zones being created. The trend line since 1989, 15 walls to over 70, is only going to accelerate.
The human dynamics will persist. Even with more fences and more autonomous systems, there will still be soldiers on both sides, still patrols that recognize each other, still informal channels that emerge. The question is whether those micro-level relationships can prevent macro-level conflict as the pressures increase.
That's the open question. If border guards on opposing sides can maintain professional relationships and even something approaching friendship across the fence, what does that say about the nature of conflict? Are borders more about domestic politics than international relations? Are the fences built for the people behind them, not the people on the other side?
There's a strong case that border fortification is primarily a domestic political signal. The wall says we are protecting you to the domestic audience, regardless of its actual security value. But the soldiers on the ground, the ones who actually manage the border day to day, they operate in a different reality, one where the other side is not an abstraction, but a set of familiar faces.
When you replace those soldiers with cameras and algorithms, you might get better detection, but you lose the human judgment that prevents false positives from becoming incidents, and incidents from becoming wars.
That's the tension of the next decade in border management. The technology is getting better, but the human element, the informal deconfliction, the boundary recognition, the tacit agreements, that's getting weaker. We might end up with borders that are more secure and more dangerous at the same time.
More secure against infiltration, more dangerous in terms of escalation risk.
And the people who fall into the gap, the migrants crossing the Sonoran Desert, the refugees drowning in the Mediterranean, the shepherds who graze too close to the fence, they're the ones who pay the price for that ambiguity.
The buffer zone as a space where state responsibility dissolves. That's the dark side of everything we've been talking about.
And it's worth remembering that when we talk about border engineering and buffer zones and deconfliction protocols, these are not abstract technical issues. They're life and death realities for the people who live in and move through these spaces.
To bring this together, every border fence creates a no man's land, whether by design or by accident. The width of that no man's land is a direct measure of the political relationship. The human dynamics in that space, the soldiers who recognize each other, the informal communication channels, the tacit rules of coexistence, are what prevent small incidents from becoming large conflicts. And as we automate border surveillance, we risk losing the human layer that makes the system work.
The next time you cross a border, remember that the line on the map is the least interesting part. The real border is the 100 meters of graded dirt, the fiber optic cables buried in the ground, the soldiers who know each other's first names, and the people who die in the space between.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1913, the Russian mathematician Andrei Markov published a paper on the statistical properties of alternating vowel consonant sequences in Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, inadvertently inventing Markov chains while trying to disprove a rival's claim that the law of large numbers didn't apply to dependent events. His paper turned a linguistic curiosity into the mathematical foundation for everything from Google's PageRank to modern AI language models.
The entire edifice of modern machine learning rests on a petty academic feud about Russian poetry. That feels right.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com, on Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.